I see Polynesian tram going down, going down. Well, Bush 2 is in the White House, passing tax reform, giving trillion to his rich friends, and stealing from the poor. Don't blink your eyes, you'll sell the store. Corporations and the Pentagon just cooking up the wars. Armies in the State House say, fuck you, General, then you'll come, then you'll come. Bush and baby Bush and the party, yeah. God, that spells G for gun, and O for oil, and D for drugs, they gave us 911, was an inside job.
George Bush in the White House, spreading fear across the land, tearing up our Bill of Rights as fast as they can, won't tell such a scam.
Well, Collins at the UN just showing diagrams. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals. He's shaking hands.
Wolfies at the World Bank, making new demands, we'll take your oil, you keep saying.
We got Evergreen in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act, just shut them down at the mouth. They took our Constitution and threw it out.
They'll call Rove in the White House and they say he's pushing prison. All his corporate buddies and dads, all the machines we cast our votes, they wipe clean.
Shooting for the world, torture and police, they sent preemptive war, the Fourth Reich's here in America.
King George in the White House is pushing folks around, chains in the backseat, polishing the ground, we're going down, we're going down.
Well, good evening, this is Truth Quest, and this is Melody, and Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and tonight I've got a very special guest, Captain Eric May. And are you there, Captain?
Yes, Melody. I can't hear you real well, but I think I'll be able to go ahead and make it okay.
Okay, well, we'll see if we can get the... How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Okay, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and... The opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. But, again, going back to Captain May, we will, he's a, what was that? are you still there, Captain May?
Yes, I am.
Okay, all right. There, I pushed the wrong button. so, anyways, I'm very pleased to have Captain May tonight, and he is a military intelligence officer and journalist, and very active in an internet group called Ghost Troop. And his bio is so long here, I really would feel better if he'd go ahead and explain it a little bit better than I am. And while we're at it, I'd like to say hi to Dr. Carlstrom again. Let him speak in.
Yes, well, it's great to be here, Melody, and just talked a little bit to Captain May, and looking very much forward to our discussion tonight for the next 2 hours. I'm looking forward to learning a lot. So maybe if we could ask Captain May to give us a kind of a brief summary of his background and where his articles and information would be posted, so how people could get in touch with him, that sort of thing. We could start that way.
Well, it'd be my pleasure to pick up there. May I?
Yes,
yes,
please.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, hello to Eric and Melody, although I'm probably going to say GT Melody. because GT stands for Ghost Group. Melody's actually one of the members of our cyber intelligence group, Ghost Group, about which I'm sure we'll speak quite a bit tonight. As are other people you've probably heard of. For instance, Eric and I were talking about Dr. Kevin Barrett, one of the luminaries of the 911 Truth member movement, the head of Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 911 Truth, who was a Ghost Group as of the last couple of years. So we're a pretty deep unit in terms of our experience and participation in the 911 Truth movement. Almost kind of like a military unit, you know, a military unit that's traveled well in a time of war has pennants that it attaches to its banner, where it says, like, it was at Anzio Beach, or it was at Normandy, or it was at Remagen. And we're kind of like that. Since our founding in 2003, we've been at just about every part of the what we call the info war, meaning the war for information control over the United States of America. We've been at Camp Casey. I was there for the Camp Casey 2005 event, recruited some Ghost Troops there. We were there at the beginning of the war. We were publishing and broadcasting during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon last year. So Ghost Troop is a much-traveled and well-seasoned unit of InfoWar veterans. Now, as to the matter of where one can find my writing, and I consider myself principally a writer, I have a background as an officer as well, so I try to be a warrior poet. That's the ideal for any officer who has the ability to write in historic times. Xenophon and Lawrence are a couple of examples for those who are scholarly. And I try to live up to that by writing. I formerly wrote for such papers as the Wall Street Journal, the Houston Chronicle, and for a couple of years there I did a gig as the NBC editorial writer in the Houston broadcast affiliate, KPRC-TV. So pretty well seasoned in the journalism area. My current flagship paper is the Lone Star Iconoclast, which some of your listeners will have heard of as the paper that in 2004, in the middle of Texas, published from Crawford, home of the Western White House, took a stand against George Bush and advocated a vote against him, push for Kerry. That was a very strong move for that part of the world, Central Texas, the heart of Texas, in 2004. And the Iconoclast has it's one of the few papers that can say it's actually read by locals in Central Texas, but also read by a good number of what I call the dissident congressional folks in D.C., and also read internationally. My editor, W. Leon Smith, recently did an interview with Al Jazeera. So it's a paper that gives us quite a long range. Now, anyone who wants to know my work can look it up through two principal news publications, the one being the Lone Star Iconoclast, and the other being an internet magazine called The Price of Liberty. The Price of Liberty. That's from a quote saying the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And those two will connect into all my work. But if you just want to remember, folks, that my name is Captain May, more broadly Captain Eric May, and that I run Ghost Troop, you can plug Captain May or Ghost Troop into any search engine, and you'll pull up as much as you care to look through. And I suppose both my gracious hosts will confirm that.
Yes, and in our little conversation before the show, Captain May and I discovered that we're both on one website, which I think we're both proud of, called PatriotsQuestion911.org.
I couldn't be happier than to be affiliated with you through that. Because, as we've said before, that's a house with many mansions, so that there are intelligence and military professionals in one section of it. There's a section for engineers and architects. There are several different disciplines that are coming together, that are rallying, to use the military term, and those terms come naturally enough to me. There are different branches of academe and intelligentsia that are rallying to expose the 911 treason. And I think that 911, Patriots Question 911, may be the best rallying point that I know of for those.
Yeah, I totally agree. Captain May, I was looking through some of your articles today, and I saw the origin of the term ghost troop, which, of course, is the group that you are affiliated with or that you're heading up. Could you explain where that term comes from? I think that might help our audience understand some of your military background, et cetera.
Sure. I'll tell you what, let me go through two things. I'll give you my military bio and then end up with ghost troop.
Okay, yeah.
You know, Melville, the great American writer, wrote my favorite book, maybe Moby Dick, my favorite American novel. Melville once said, the sea was my Harvard and my Yale college. And in my case, it was the Army. I dropped out of high school and joined the Army when I was 17, back in 77, and stayed in 3 years. My first field was one that I didn't think much of at the time, but it's become very relevant. It was I was a chemical staff specialist, which means my expertise was in nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare. My last year in that tour, enlisted tour in the Army, I was a sergeant, and I taught the nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare defense course for 3 Corps at Fort Hood. After coming out of the Army at a rather young age, 20, I stayed in the reserves, actually the National Guard in Texas, and came home to Houston where I went to college at the University of Houston and took my degree 5 years later in Latin and Greek. Thereafter, I took a commission as a second lieutenant in the area of military intelligence, and I went to intelligence training and did pretty much the routine things that all intelligence officers do. Until in 1987, the Army decided, well, you know, you know Latin and Greek, I would like to try Russian. Now, this was what I like to say as a joke. This is in the good old days of the Cold War when Russian was a great thing to know. So I spent a couple of years out of the Presidio of Monterey, so-called Defense Language Institute, studying Russian. And I suppose the diplomatic highlight of my small military career at that point was being a translator-interpreter for the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty signed under Reagan and Gorbachev back in 1988. Incidentally, interestingly enough, which as a result of our geopolitical aggression is now being abrogated by the Russian side because they're prepared to start deploying intermediate nuclear forces again. So, interesting historical side note there. I came out of the active Army in 1989 and returned to, again, home of Houston, Texas, and began to teach in a local Latin Catholic high school. I taught Latin, Greek, and Russian, as well as, incidentally, geography at a high school level. Maintained membership in the 75th Division, which was a reserve unit that specifically involved itself in high-level military exercises. We put on simulations of war games for everything from brigade staff up to corps-level staff. And my specialty in that unit was as an OP4 controller, OP4 being the military acronym for opposing forces. After 5 years of that, I was selected as the public affairs officer for the division and sent to the Joint Military Public Affairs School called the Defense Information School, DINFOS, at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana. By the time I came out of finished my reserve service in 1997, I was part of the General Staff of the 75th Division as the public affairs officer. At that point, I had 3 specialties: nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare being the one, military intelligence, and then public affairs. So I have a pretty good background for understanding the more salient elements of so-called global war now, all the way from its causes, which are the WMD claim, to the info war itself, meaning the propaganda effort. After coming off the reserves, as I noted earlier, did quite a bit of writing in the Houston area for various media affiliates. And I was what was specifically called a ghostwriter, meaning that I would write things for corporate and political VIPs who would publish it under their name, and that was my livelihood. I wrote for people like, oh, Lord, people you've heard of like Ken Lay, Colin Powell, corporations, Enron, Texaco, Conoco. I mean, this is Houston. This is Oilville. So I did a lot of ghostwriting and pretty much stayed in that area of things until the current war started, which brings us to Ghost Troop the Unit. When the Iraq war started, I'd been on record for a decade as saying that a move into Iraq would turn into a quicksand war. I think I had claimed credit for inventing that phrase. And I think, incidentally, one of the reasons it's not used by the contemporary media is that they don't want people to look that phrase up and come up with my bio. Going into April, or March-April of 2003, as we were storming across the desert up north from Kuwait up the Euphrates Valley toward Baghdad, I published my most a piece that specifically predicted that if we had persisted, we were going to wind up in a quicksand war and perhaps a world war. About one day, I remember publishing that piece. My editor called me on April Fool's Day, April 1st, 2003. This was 2 days, 3 days before we got to Baghdad, and said, you know, I'm going to run your piece, but it's the craziest thing I've ever read. The Army's going to reach Baghdad in the next couple of days. They're going to prove that everything you're predicting is absurd. Now, this was an editor, as so many of them were, who was a neocon, a Bush stan, and had to serve a day in uniform. And so that piece ran April 3rd, 2003. The next night, and here we'll bring it into the frame of reference of many of your readers, we reached Baghdad, meaning the U.S. Army, and selected Marine forces, reached Baghdad, and the story being put out on the various media was that we were going to surround Baghdad and think of the next move, you know, reduce Baghdad. But all of a sudden, Friday night, April 4th, in the U.S., the story came out that there was a big battle at Baghdad Airport, and the 37th Cavalry, the scout unit for the 3rd Infantry Division, was in the thick of it. The next morning, Baghdad Bob, the Iraqi Information Minister, put out a report that saying April 5th, Saturday morning, 2003, that they, meaning the Iraqis, were still holding Baghdad Airport, had sustained an American attack, and had inflicted 300 deaths on U.S. forces. Now, at that point, the name Baghdad Bob was born. The story of a fight at Baghdad Airport was dropped. The Pentagon canceled all briefings. President Bush flew off to England to talk to Blair, this in the middle of the climactic moment of his war. Condi Rice flew off to Moscow to talk to Putin. There was a total information blackout on all the germane issues of the war, which were, for heaven's sake, what was happening in Baghdad, and suddenly the American people met a young lady for the first time. Bonus points, Doc, for anybody who can tell me her name. Jessica Lynch.
Well, Jessica Lynch, yeah.
All of a sudden, Jessica Lynch became a household. Now, you've got to think about it this way. Pretend like you and I are sitting down watching the Super Bowl, and it's 2 minutes from the end of the Super Bowl, and there's a goal line stand beside the Super Bowl. This is analogous to the idea that the American Army has surrounded Baghdad. If for the last 2 minutes of that game you don't see the plays, but only see the cheerleader, something is wrong. So the switch to Jessica Lynch, which was hard to pick up at the time, you know, most people weren't information experts or military information experts. The switch to that Jessica Lynch was confirmation of I did not concoct this as a theory. I saw it as it was happening and knew very well that what was happening was that there was a major battle being covered up by the public affairs and media apparatus. I'd had experience in both areas. But Jessica Lynch became the main story for 3 days. And then the next thing you know, you have the next iconic moment, which is the fall of Saddam Hussein's statue. So what you get is basically Baghdad Bob says there's a battle at the airport, but that story gets wiped out by Jessica Lynch. Then a few days later, the American public zooms back in to Baghdad to see the statue falling. So the question remains, what happened in those 3 or 4 days? And the answer is the Battle of Baghdad happened in those days, and a lot of American boys died. And people ask me how many, and the answer is so many that the public affairs and media apparatus censored it out and did not let the public know about it at the time and have not talked about it since.
This is a story that I hadn't heard before. I don't know how many Americans are aware of this. I suppose not too many of us. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. I mean, here's the deal. No one has heard about it with the official, the mainstream media apparatus. They did what was called an embargo of the story, meaning the media willingly self-censored. But, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into this in a little while, the media is a willing accomplice to the neocon project for world domination through the Middle East war. You know, the American media has, in effect, become everything that Dr. Goebbels envisioned for the German media in World War II. It's just that instead of being run by one propaganda ministry under the Reich, being run by, five different consortia that represented an effective cartel of information in the United States?
Right. And, yeah.
They censored out the story. The story never got to the people. The story that did get to the people was bogus. Jessica Lynch, and you know, God bless her, you know, she sustained wounds that will last her for the rest of her life, but Jessica Lynch was caught in an ambush and blacked out from the minute it started. She never, this idea that she locked and loaded two clips and blasted Iraqis, you know, while she was being bayoneted, that was BS put out by public affairs the first day. The idea that she was rescued by a heroic special forces raid, that was BS because the Iraqis knew which way the war was going and they tried to turn her over. You know, the most special thing about that special forces raid was the special cameraman. And then the whole pull down of the Saddam Hussein statue, folks, next time you see it, if you ever see it again, notice that they don't give you a broad picture. They do not show you a picture of 10,000 Iraqis standing around with their fists up in the air calling for the statue to be called down, and the reason for that is there were only about 100 present. The exits to that plaza were all being shut off by military forces. That was a contrived shot.
Another staged event, yeah.
You know, it was a PR job. All the way up to Bush's proclamation 3 weeks later of mission accomplished, you know, we have prevailed in Iraq. You know, there's no Latin saying, and I can't resist putting in at least one every interview, which is potens quia vident to the pose. They can do it because they seem to be able to do it. That's the object of propaganda. You convince people that you won, and then maybe you did it. You know, you can't tell people you don't know you won and say you're the winner. So we said we'd won. And everything we did was to support that premise, that we had won. So the American public today routinely hears about, in fact, listen, just listen to this phrase. You'll hear it again within a week. You know how that old rule about how you learn a new word or a new phrase and you hear it three times a month? You'll notice that you never hear the phrase Battle of Baghdad. What you hear is the fall of Baghdad. You know, oh, we've had several problems in Iraq since the fall of Baghdad, says ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News. But the fall is kind of the passive voice, man. Baghdad didn't fall. Do you really think those Iraqis just handed over the keys to the city? I mean, it wasn't like liberating Paris where the mayor came out and pissed the GI out of the chief. You know, this was their city. The fall of Baghdad did not just happen. Baghdad was taken through a bloody battle. Baghdad Airport, April 5th, my best information, and I published this, is that American forces American commanders went nuclear. We used a neutron warhead at the Baghdad Airport, which accounts for much of the information that came out later about how there was a major decontamination operation at the Baghdad Airport and whatnot. That whole area is verboten. It's hard for the American people to understand that what they call free press, or what they've been taught in their high school civics class, was free press. I call media cartel. And what they think of as frank expose by, you know, leftist, inimical, radical, atheist journalists who just want to gut the White House, I think of as apparatchiks of a propaganda apparatus. I see no difference in the American media of 2005, 2007, and the Soviet media of 1985 and 1987. I mean, I used to read newspaper articles by Pravda, Vestia, Krasnaya Zvezda, all these people. There were whole fleets of professionals who were employed writing things that were false in the Soviet Union. And they had this kind of, you know, they mollified their consciences and wrote what they were told to write, and they were telling falsehoods. And I remember when I was studying Russian, having brilliant people teaching me, chess masters who were defectors, you know, people who were smart enough to get out of the country in the first place. Chess masters, composers, writers, historians, all these people who were brilliant people. Probably the most brilliant ensemble of people I ever saw was the people who were teaching me Russian in the mid-80s. And every one of them said that they'd been totally duped by the Soviet media apparatus.
Yeah.
It's the old Hitlerian rule. If you take a big lie and tell it often enough, people absorb it as their worldview.
Right, and we have so many very, very smart Americans who sit down in front of the evening news, perhaps the news hour or something like that, and really do believe that they are getting the essence of what's going on in the world. So,
right, they think that when they switch from Fox to MSNBC, they have really changed worldviews.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
all they've done is gone from News Corp to Viacom to MSNBC is part of NBC, which is part of GE. So I don't care if you do like Oberman. And I do like Oberman. You know, he's fun, Keith Oberman show. But essentially, you're talking about a puppet held by a puppet, held by a puppet, which belongs to General Electric.
So
you might as well call it Countdown. Instead of Countdown with Keith Oberman, you should call it Countdown with Keith Oberman, presented by General Electric. And that plays opposite Fox, which is Bill O'Reilly at the same hour. But Keith Oberman ain't going to talk about 9/11, the Battle of Baghdad, the covered-up body count, the push toward world war with Iran, the influence of the Israel lobby or the neocons over war decisions. Keith Oberman ain't going to talk about that any more than Riley is.
So he would be, in effect, what we call a left gatekeeper, would you say?
Oh, God, yes.
So,
that would, by the way, you know, you talk about, like, oh, Amy Goodman, same racket.
Yeah.
I mean, Pacifica. When's the last time anybody heard Pacifica break a story? National propaganda. You say national public radio. I say national propaganda radio.
Captain May, before we leave the Ghost Troop, I remember looking in your article, and you mentioned something about using that name in honor of the American soldiers who died without any recognition at the Battle of Baghdad. Isn't that correct?
Thank you for bringing that up, Doc. Yeah, the simple fact is that after the Battle of Baghdad, I began what was called a mission of conscience, which all officers are trained to do. It means you see something so egregiously against your oath to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you have to stand against it, no matter the consequence. In my mission of conscience, I began to tell the truth to various connections I had about the Battle of Baghdad. And I found that everybody who was part of my sphere in the mainstream media, and I had a pretty wide sphere of mainstream contact, was scared witless to talk about the Battle of Baghdad. So what I wound up doing was becoming part of an expanding circle of military people who did know about the Battle of Baghdad or receptive to it, and we began to call ourselves Ghost Troop in honor of the soldiers and Marines who lost their lives in the Battle of Baghdad but received no reckoning from the public. And the view for us, you know, all having had military experience, in some cases military careers, a great number of combat veterans, our view was that When you sign the dotted line and join the military, you know, the minimum you get is recognition for dying, you know, for heaven's sake. And so we became Ghost Troop. Specifically, that goes back to the Battle of Baghdad Airport. The thing Baghdad Bob said happened that the media suddenly started saying didn't happen. The 37th Cavalry was involved in that action, and the 37th Cavalry, it's called a squadron, was made up of six different troops. Troop is the cavalry equivalent to company. And those companies were A for Alpha, B for Bravo, C for Charlie, D for Delta, E for Echo, and F for Foxtrot. So we thought, well, what the hell? We'll become the seventh unit, and we'll become G for Ghost Group. So we're the Ghost Group. And sometimes you'll see us written as the Ghost Group, comma, 37th Cavalry. Then we became Ghost Group, comma, 37th Cyber Cavalry, because we used all the techniques that we've been taught for scouting and raiding through the internet medium. So Ghost Group went from being largely an honorary group, which was dedicated to preserving the memory of those who were unacknowledged in the Battle of Baghdad, to becoming a unit that was interested in wider issues. And in 2004, a Marine captain, Captain Jeff Cross, joined the unit and began to talk with me extensively. He had been a 9/11 witness. And that's when we became active in the whole 9/11 truth scenario.
Excellent. Well, this is a perfect segue then to the next interesting topic, which is your 9/11 to be Redux topic, which you've written on. And could you explain a little bit about your activities in Ghost Troop in regard to that?
Sure. You have to say that there were three key areas of Ghost Troop interest. Two of them were the best in the world in. One of them is the Battle of Baghdad cover-up. Now, military folks love acronyms. So Battle of Baghdad cover-up, listen to it with me, each letter. Battle of B, of O, Baghdad B, cover-up, we make cover, then up, cut. Bob cut. The first mission was Bob cut, and that was exposing the fact that there had been an entire battle in Baghdad which had been covered up, and through that, exposing the fact that the military apparatus is collaborating with the media apparatus to abrogate all the rules of the military and all the efforts of the media to produce false information for the American people. In effect, Bob Cut for us proved that the American people were not sovereign and we were being led to a world war like a bull with a nose through a ring through its nose. 9/11, there's so much written and spoken about that that I would pretend to be one of the experts on that. I read all the latest research and know many of the leading researchers. But 9/11, we weren't even hip to until 2004. But what happened very quickly after we reached 9/11 is, I suppose this is as a result of having my background in military intelligence and having been involved in high-level war game scenarios, I inferred from the premises the conclusion, which was, if the government created a false flag attack on 9/11, if 9/11 is an inside job in order to lead us to World War III, to a geopolitical takeover of the Middle East, which is the new heartland, you remember the heartland theory, the heartland for petrochemical resources worldwide. If 9/11 was the fuse to bring us into a takeover of the world, if we are stalling out, which in 2004 we clearly were, you know, the three-month piece of cake war was in the past, and nobody believed that anymore at that point. Then the conclusion was that the American public had to be fully mobilized to support the world war effort. And by the way, before anyone says, oh, my God, you're talking about world war, first, that ain't even smart anymore because everybody's talking about world war. But second, back in 2004, we were slow getting 9/11. We were smart enough to realize global war is just a synonym for world war. When they called this a global war on terror, they meant World War III. So since 9/11 had started us down the road, and we were down the road, and the military was figuring out we were overextended, overcommitted, the only answer was another 9/11 event to create a full mobilization by the American people. So 9/11 has been called by Dr. Griffin and others of the New Pearl Harbor. Well, we needed a new Pearl Harbor. And at the time, the media was telling us that the next 9/11 was not a matter of if, but a matter of when. So we put it together in our ruminations and realized that the right code to give that, since it was not a matter of if it was going to be, but when it was going to be, it said, well, this is the 9/11 to be the next 911, the 911 to be. So we gave it the operational code. You know, again, everything we do, you're going to find military phrases in it. 911-2, capital letter B. 911-2B, the mission code. And we've been working the 911-2B mission for 3 years now. Along the way, we read the media cycle. We can read, you know, once you accept the premise, and many of, I think probably most of the people listening to us discuss this matter now, have accepted the premise that 911 was a contrived event, is an inside job. Once you really accept that, it's inevitable. The inexorable conclusion is that the bunch of traitors who did 911 must carry out 911-2B. Otherwise, they're going to want to hang by the neck. Once you accept the premise that the reason 911 is not understood by the public is that there is a media apparatus that job is not to inform, but to disinform, then you understand that the only way off the hook for that media apparatus is exactly what they've been setting us up to believe, that there is a 911 to be, another one, coming up. So we've watched media cycles for those 3 years, and we've been able to have amazing accuracy in predicting events that look like they may have been potential 911 to be events. Specifically, we've worked in the Houston petrochemical industry. The same way that, once again, you're a geographer and a geopolitician, so this will be easy. If it is the case, and I imagine the majority of your readers and listeners are familiar with this argument, that the Israel lobby was at least partly behind the war, and if one accepts that the Israel lobby is just a polite word for world Zionism, which I think, then one must conclude, or one can conclude quite easily, that the reason 9/11 happened in New York City, the most heavily infiltrated, the most heavily controlled city by world Zionism, was, it's not accidental. There's linkage. So what we did is we started working off a premise that I first published in the Houston Chronicle even before the war, after 9/11, which was that the next best target for al-Qaeda, whoever that was, whether you think that's al-Qaeda and 19 Arab hijackers and bin Laden, or whether you think that's al-CIA, duh, and a bunch of rogue lawyers who are trying to set it all up to look like al-Qaeda and bin Laden, whoever it is, the rational next choice for targets was Houston petrochemical area. So we started working on that scenario, and we effectively predicted, attacks, which turned out to be major petrochemical explosions. We predicted, we predicted 331, March 31st, 2004. We predicted that 2 days after Madrid. It was the Madrid bombing that broke a lot of barriers down for us. That was so clearly an inside job. We predicted 331, and Texas City British Petroleum blew up on 330, sending petroleum, gasoline, premium gasoline futures to the highest level in history. We predicted 7/27/2005. All these predictions, by the way, are used in Texas Center. And the next day, 28th of July 2005, Texas City British Petroleum blew up again, sending crude oil prices to the highest level in history.
Captain Maiden, some of these people may not be aware that there was also drills going on at the time of...
In all these cases, there were concurrent military drills simulating al-Qaeda terror strikes against a small U.S. port city. Some of your listeners will remember that 2 years ago, in the summer of 2005, there was a big media push suggesting that there would be a al-Qaeda nuke exploding in one of our port cities. They were working that all over the media for like 4 months, and believing, as we believe, that the 911-2D scenario was an active military scenario, we couldn't help but to think that it was being set up. I should tell your listeners that every time we predicted the Houston Metro petrochemical attack, when I say Texas City blew up, folks, Texas City is 25 miles from the center of downtown Houston. It is the Houston Metro suburb. We've effectively anticipated explosions in Texas City or other Houston petrochemical suburbs on 3/31/2004. We missed that by a day. It happened on 3/30. 9/27/2004, we hit that spot on. That was New Caney, Texas. Major pipeline sabotage. Initially, Al-Qaeda, supposedly, claimed credit. 7/27/2005, we missed that by a day. Texas City went up the next day. And the last one was Baytown, Texas. We were spot on, but we predicted 7/2. So, excuse me, we predicted 7/1, and it happened on 7/2. Now, this, I'll tell you what, anybody out there who really thinks that this is random, you pick Houston, Texas, and you put your money down on when the next time the petrochemical industry is going to have a major catastrophe.
Well, this is very fascinating, Captain May, that we have a military intelligence man like yourself essentially working against the military industrial complex here in a battle of wits, apparently. But not just you. You also have your ghost troops working with you. And now, would there be danger of repercussions by the much larger team that you're competing against here?
Well, utterly. And you know, from the time I got into this mission, my great fear was that I would be assassinated.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're dealing with, you know, this all becomes very conjectural, academic, and fun until you actually think about being like me, a former sworn commissioned officer with a former top secret clearance, actually playing against your own team because your team has become, ruled by a traitorous commander in chief.
Right.
You know, once you start putting those terms on it, and, you know, there are smarter people, but I'm not stupid, you know, you can wind up dead. And I worried about that in 2003 and 2004. After the first accurate Texas City prediction in March of 2004, I actually tried to exfiltrate out of the country to Canada. I got busted at the border, and they handed me over to Homeland Security. In other words, I did everything you would do, being a rational man who has a rational desire to keep living. Once you realize, people say, well, what did you do after you realized that you'd actually, you know, figured out their operational plan and that you preempted their attempt to blow up Texas City? And the answer is, I tried to get the hell out of Dodge. What would you do? So
right.
I tried to run, and I came back, and, you know, after I got busted at the border, I came back to the U.S. about as, you know, as happy as a hound dog that had gotten kicked. And when I came back to the U.S., I got back into the Enzo War. And then I dropped out again in 2004, after about 18 months in the Enzo War. I dropped out. You know, my nerves were shot, candidly. You know, you've had a few calls from the Secret Service, the FBI. You know, you suspect the CIA. Got disinfo people harassing you, threatening your wife with death. I mean, please don't label me as a hero. You know, I was the wrong guy at the wrong place. So I tried to get out again Thanksgiving of 2004 and, in fact, stayed out until the London bombing, which was 7/7/2005. By that point, I had published a very small circulation article predicting that the next attack would be on 7/27. I predicted that a week before the 7/7 bombings in London. And so when the 7/7 attack happened, I realized that the big 9/11/2B attempt in the U.S. was immediately ahead. And the first thing I did was went to my wife's priest, like most Latin and Greek majors in college, I was a good pagan. But I thought, before I get back into this crap, I'm going to get baptized. And I was actually baptized. I have a very interesting baptismal certificate. It's issued under emergency circumstances because my priest thought I might get assassinated. And I worried totally in 2005 and 2006. Candidly, it's only been the last year that I haven't been worried. And your question is probably, well, why?
Yes.
And the answer is, it's too late to worry. I have a neurological disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, which, according to statistics, I have between half a year and 2 years to live. You know,
Well, I hope you'll forgive me for calling you a hero. Certainly, your courage is very inspiring, and I think many people will get inspired by your story.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I could trade all the inspiration and the compliments for another 3 decades of life, which is what I should have at my age, I would. But I wouldn't back out of doing the mission because I know what the mission has done. So, here are the odds. You say, well, Lou Gehrig's disease, I've heard of that. God, Pat May got that. But what are the odds? And the answer is the odds are 3 in 100,000. The odds that you, Eric, or you, Melody, will hear from your doctor in the next year that you have Lou Gehrig's disease, a progressive neurological disorder which will render you incapable of every voluntary physical motion, ultimately concluding in collapse of diaphragm and suffocation, the odds of that are 3 in 100,000. So, I think I've probably been neurotoxin. So the simple answer is, I'm better at my job than I ever was because I don't fear assassination anymore. I figure it's already been done.
Boy.
Well, I know you're sorry to hear it, but I'm even more sorry to say it, brother.
Yes, yeah, of course. Well, it's tremendous that you are putting so many pieces together here in terms of your understanding. In one of your articles, you described the 911 2B, these predictions, and you're talking about the attempt of the U.S. government to false flag us, and of course that means setting up an operation that can be blamed on your enemy, so-called, the Muslim countries that you want to invade. False flag us into World War III for Israel and oil, and that this is being mainly driven by what you called WASP Illuminists and Jewish Kabbalists. Could you explain maybe for our audience how you put this all together and how you view this this small cadre of elite conspirators that are moving us in this direction?
Sure. Now, probably the best jump-off point to this, because people are going to say, man, this guy's saying all kinds of things I haven't heard before. And my answer is, well, folks, that's because they didn't want you to hear it. And they scared off or bought off people who were able to figure it out and say it. Remember, my background was military intelligence and media. And the two areas where you have been BS for the last 5 years have been intelligence and media. So it's not inherently shocking that I would have insights that are radical or unheard of. It used to be tough to say that the two geostrategic priorities of this war were oil and Israel, but that got a hell of a lot easier last week because Alan Greenspan, himself a Jew, you know, the former head of the Federal Reserve, he came out and said that oil was one of the big motives behind this war. And he said, when he said this, Alan Greenspan, and, you know, let's accept that Alan Greenspan is smarter about the world out there than you and me and Melody put together. I'm willing to say that. Well, Alan Greenspan said, I hate to say something that's politically unfavorable, but oil was a big cause in this war. All right, so the question has to emerge. Well, why in the hell haven't we heard this from ABC, Fox News, MSNBC, and, you know, AMTV radio? Why haven't we heard this? Why haven't we read this in the New York Times? And the answer is, because, dummy, they were all doing propaganda against you. Greenspan comes out and says this, and people think it's some kind of a revelation. I mean, you're a geographer, Doc. I mean, you know, just remember those charts that you artless geographers used to make us poor students learn? We had the red and blue, you know, bauxite and iron deposits and, you know, all these things. Well, where does it all stack up? What's the pivot point of the world oil supply? You know, and the answer is, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, you know, coincidentally.
Right.
So oil was easy. The second one, Israel, the one against which there is the greatest resistance. If you say that, you're immediately attacked as an anti-Semite. And it's become a case. And, you know, people try to get around and think, oh, we're not going to talk about Israel, we're going to talk about Zionism. Or, oh, we're not going to talk about Zionism, we're going to talk about imperialism. Or, you know, there are all these attempts to get around saying that there may be such a thing as, in the same way that before World War II, there was a well-recognized phenomenon of German ethnocentricity, which led to the emergence of a U.S., it was called the Bund. It was basically an organization of people who were involved in trying to get American public opinion to swing behind Germany. And it'd be silly not to say that there was a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, group that was trying to swing American public opinion behind Britain. And the government imprisoned about 250,000 U.S. citizens because it was openly acknowledged that there was a Japanese-American ethnic predisposition to swinging behind Japan. Well, all that is well and good. It's historic, and it meets with every sociological tenet that I've ever heard of. But if you say that there is a Jewish-American attempt to swing U.S. public opinion behind the war that primarily furthers Israeli geopolitical interests, oh, my God, you're attacked from 20 different directions. I mean, think about what's happened recently with the Hersheimer-Walt report and now book. Or think about what's happened to Professor Finkelstein at Purdue. You know, one can't talk about these things. But the simple fact is that there are two ethno groups behind this. This is if you want to call it a religious war, and this war should be looked at. Look, the Muslim world looks at it as a religious crusade. Then one must understand, this is primarily a Judeo-Christian war against Islam. I mean, how stupid do you have to believe be not to see that? For God's sake, there are no Iranian or Iraqi or Lebanese armies attacking New York. You know, that's why they had to create 9/11, so that you could create the boogeyman that said that Islamic forces are attacking us. But the simple truth is, all the attacks in the Middle East are coming from Israel north and from the U.S. transatlantic. So these are the interested parties behind this war. It is a Judeo-Christian war against Islam. It is an Anglo-Jewish war against Arabo-Persians. I mean, you know, all these terms of the academic craft should be employed to evaluate this geostrategic reality called the global war, but they're not. So we simply, you know, we overstep those taboos like we overstep all of them. You know, I wasn't taught to be polite when I was an intel officer. I was taught to be on target, you know, as best I could. Now, what we found is that when you look at the elites of the United States, you're talking about, okay, let's back up a second. If you go to the inner city and you deal with, let's say, a group I used to teach, which was Hispanic youth in inner city Houston, what one found pretty quickly was that the powerful Hispanic members of my school belonged to secret societies. And those societies were known as the South Side Crips or the Latin Kings. Or if you went across the tracks the wrong way, you'd be dealing with the Bloods, you know, or the Wayside Posse. There were gangs, and they used all kinds of hidden iconography to communicate. They wrote in code. So the people you thought were dumb because they couldn't pass geography or English were still quite smart about talking to each other. If you look at prison culture now, you'll find that every ethnicity has its own gang. You know, that's an ineluctable part of prison society now. Any sociologist dealing with the issue would find that out. There are secret societies, and there are codes, there are gangs, and they dominate the interior life of prisons. So if one accepts to combine the profane with the sublime, if one accepts the idea that according to the Hobbesian worldview, you know, the worldview that the world is a Leviathan, that each nation is a Leviathan, what's the difference between a prison and a country? And the answer is not much except the names of the gangs. So the gangs that run America are the Freemasons or Illuminatus, and you know, they themselves are a subset of a broader set of mysticism out of the Middle East called Kabbalah. So you get these secret societies that are at the heart of you know, the Judeo-Christian ruling elite, and you find out that their marks are all over what we call the info war. They are unmistakable marks. Shall we talk about a few of them?
Yes, please.
Sure. I mean, 9/11. Well, let's talk as if you're a mathematician. 9-11 is interesting. It's two consecutive odd integers, 5 and 11. 9-11 is also interesting because it happens to be the exact same date code that produces the telephone code, which you call when something so dreadful happens that you need police protection. In other words, if you and I were trying to invent the perfect date code to have an attack, to turn the American public into a police state, what date code would we come up with?
9-11. Right. Yeah.
Can that also be termed like a neurolingual programming of sorts?
Yeah, that's real good. That's fine. If you want to throw it in Jungian terms, it could be called an archetype. I mean, there are many different terms to express the same idea, which is that you create linkages. If you're trying to do propaganda, if you're trying to create, momentum, then you create linkages. And, if you want to call those mental linkages or neurological parallels or whatever, that's a fine thing. I mean, all those are helpful terms. It should be thought of in those terms. Another way of looking at it is that if you look at the towers themselves, just picture them across at the skyline of Manhattan, what number do you get? 11. And coincidentally, in this system of people say, oh my God, he's talking about numerology. Well, really I'm talking about Chaldean numerics. I'm talking about a number code based on 1 through 9 instead of 1 through 10. The mystic Kabbalah and Illuminati systems are based on Chaldean numerology. If you go to 9-11, the 11 itself represents like the New York skyline. It represents the emergency code. As I said, we really got our final proof enough to get us working on this. And by the way, I'm not an expert on this, but I've kind of become an expert. Cryptanalysis, the breaking of codes, is part of the art of military intelligence. Now, my background was as a linguist, Russian, Latin, Greek, and Spanish. And those are my languages. But number languages are just an extension of that idea. We got our breakthrough on 3/11/2004. Now, if you think about 9/11, New York, and 3/11, Madrid. Well, what are the languages? Well, one of them is both ends with 11, but the other is that 9 and 3 are square root and square of the same number. 3 squared is 9, 9 square root is 3. But the thing that really broke it for me beyond all others was if you had to take a wild guess at how many days exactly are between 9/11/2001 and 3/11/2004, between the New York and Madrid attacks, there are 911 days precisely. When we caught that one, it went way past, it went up into the astronomical odds category. You could say the other stuff is just what? And we can go on with the stuff forever. In the World Trade Centers, how many stories in each of the World Trade Centers?
110.
Knock the zero off because there is no zero in Chaldean numerology. 11.
Mm-hmm.
How many days from 9/11 to the end of the year? 111. But the big one that got us was that we realized there were, and this was not our novel realization, it was put out on the internet as a factoid, that between 9/11/2001, New York, and 3/11/2004, Madrid, there were exactly 911 days. But once you just accept the premise that perhaps these aren't being done by radical Muslims at all, but they are being done by Western governments who are interested in grabbing the oil supplies of the Middle East, much in the same way that the Crusades were all about supply routes and trade. Once you accept these geopolitical realities, it doesn't become hard at all to think that, Madrid 3/11 was 3 days before the Spanish elections, which the nationalists who were pro-war party were losing. So what did they do? They had a false flag terror attack, and they didn't blame it on the Muslims, by the way. That was the U.S. propaganda story. It was not blamed on Al-Qaeda in Madrid. It was blamed on the Basque separatists, ETA, the ETA movement. So what you get is you get a multifaceted false flag attack, which is used for different propagandistic purposes by different governments, depending on what their particular need is at the point. you know. I mean, you got to pretend not to figure it. So, and then you say, okay, well, there's 9-11, 3-11. Ah, just more coincidence. This guy's on something. All right. Well, taking aside the fact that we started on the basis of this numerological ciphering, so taking apart the basis of the fact that we started predicting petrochemical explosions, let's think of the next major attack, which was 7-7-2005.
Kevin, may I need to take a break here just a second? Just
sure.
For, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. It's now 10:01, and this is Truth Quest with Melody and with Dr. Carlstrom, and as our guest we have Captain Eric May. Go ahead.
Back on?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so 7-7 with London. Look, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist, but I'm not the one who made the attack date for London be 7 times 11. I'm not. I mean, 7-7 was, somebody picked those numbers. If the Western government, dominated by Kabbalists and Illuminatus, are not picking these dates as date codes, then clearly Al-Qaeda is, and why aren't people talking about it? Unless one makes the argument that, no, all these things are simply intricately attached to 11 as a matter of coincidence. My reply to that would be, oh, really, that's interesting, because the next coincidence was the attack in Amman, Jordan. Remember hearing about that one? The Amman, Jordan bombings resulted in the removal of the Jordanian government, the cabinet, which was replaced, and the new prime minister of Jordan became the former ambassador to Israel. In the Jordanian bombings, the Amman, Jordan bombings, the people who were killed were Palestinian intelligence leaders. So why on earth did Al-Qaeda do an attack that was so totally beneficial to Israel? And furthermore, why did they do it on 11-9? Now, that's extremely interesting. 9-11 was New York, and the one of the next major attacks was Amman. That was 11-9, which is 9-11 reversed. Unless you're in the Middle East, and they always give the day number first, so 11-9 was actually 9-11 in the Middle East.
You know, I think some of our listeners might be scratching their heads right now, but I've done enough reading to think that you're onto something here to be taken seriously. And yet I ask this question, when there apparently our ruling elite plays with these kinds of numbers, do you suspect that there is, this is a kind of a game for them, that this is just funny, or that they think there's some kind of occult power to these numbers or something like that?
Well, my answer would probably be all the above, then some. If their inside joke, if one wants to look at it, if one wants to take the view that these are psychopathic, you know, deranged people, which I do believe is the case. You know, people say, oh, my God, when you look at the biographies of Hitler and Goering, Goebbels and Himmler, they're all like sickos. And the answer is, well, yes, of course. Who do you think carries out world wars? You know, it's not the kind of thing that your Aunt Flo is going to consider. So the one answer would be yes, they're demented people who, to put it in an academic context, they're like Straussians who believe that they're a little bit smarter than everybody else about knowing what's really going on. If you've ever studied with Straussians, that's their M.O. When I talk about Straussians, I'm talking about Leo Strauss, who's kind
right.
of
an yeah.
intellectual godfather of the neocon movement. So on the one hand, they feel superior and smarter. If you want to say it's their inside joke, that's fine. Another thing is they are part of secret societies. They believe in numbers the way, you know, people believe in the stars. I mean, we have parallel disciplines. We have astronomy, and then we have astrology. Astrology has been much more dominant in world history than astronomy. Well, and people still read their horoscopes. The newspapers still put it on paper. In the same way, we have numericists, I guess we call them, which means mathematicians. We have numerologists. It's no more strange to think that numerological significance gives power than it is to think that doing something under a certain astrological sign gives power. Or going back to the ancient Roman times, you know, one I'm more comfortable with, it was my discipline, there were certain days that were just absolutely taboo days. And there were other days that were absolutely propitious days. None of this is unusual unless we, when we think about the fact that we are superstitious in our own way. everybody is superstitious in their own way. And people who are part of the WASP and Jewish secret society, the Illuminatus Kabbalah racket, they have their own hidden code. That's what we're really talking about. We're talking about a code that they both use to feel superior, that they believe in on a mystical level, and that they find exceedingly practical because you can do things like talk about things proportionately and talk about significant dates. It's like, the Catholic Church has two calendars. There's the calendar that the public goes by, and everybody uses that. And then there's the ecclesiastic calendar, the liturgical calendar is called, and under which the entire year is divided into different things. I mean, does anyone think it's impossible when somebody says, I'll see you on the eve of the Feast of St. Stephen's? I mean, there's nothing strange about that, the two Catholic priests talking. And there's nothing strange about these numerological concepts to the people who are insiders in this dominant elite that runs the New World Order. It runs the UK, the US, and I think Israel. So this code allows them to coordinate between themselves. It's very much like a gang. And, you know, it was, and I was very naive about gangs when I first started teaching inner city. But I remember gangsters, gangbangers, these are pimps, they're part of gangs. They told me, Mr. May, you don't ever do anything in a gang without signing it, mister. I said, what do you mean? They said, you gotta do the signal. You gotta sign it. No sense in doing it if you're not gonna sign it. And that is a very profound concept. And it opened me to the idea that the numerological or date code significance of these events was not accidental. So let me go to the last one and then we'll get off the date code thing. And that would be, so we talked about four of them right now. And look, folks, you go look up Al-Qaeda attacks and you're going to find these are the biggies. New York, 9/11. Madrid, 3/11. London, 7/7. Jordan, 11/9. And then the next one, of course, was Mumbai last year. 7/11. So you've got 9/11, 3/11, 7/11, 7/7, and 11/9. You go talk to a mathematician and figure the odds. And you say, 7/11, yeah, it was India. Yeah, it was. It was also the eastern part of the Middle Eastern world, and 7/11 happened exactly one day before the Israelis launched an attack north into Lebanon. I mean, and look at it geopolitically, what's the answer? There was a worldwide terrorist attack on India to give India a casus belli against Pakistan in case Pakistan and the Middle Eastern countries didn't stay out of Israel's business in launching a war on Lebanon. So the number code almost becomes my, what would you say? It's like my cliff notes. It's my cheat sheet to understand the events of the global war.
Yeah, I guess if I could just interject, we both admire Professor Michel Chudzinski in Canada, professor of economics up there, and he was one of the first that have become many to point out that Al-Qaeda was always a creature of American foreign policy, and the CIA, in fact, it started up in the 80s in the conflict in Afghanistan at that time, and he especially has documented that Al-Qaeda has remained under the influence of its U.S. government sponsors.
Yeah, we find it convenient in my circles not even to talk about Al-Qaeda. We just call it Al-CIA.
Yeah. Well, one more question about this religion thing, Captain May, because I really find this fascinating, these insights. Okay, so you mentioned that the war is a Judeo-Christian war against the Muslim world on the one hand, and that it does appear to be that way on one level. But then on the other hand, the people that are driving us into this war are very mystically oriented towards numerology. It does not sound like typical Judeo-Christianity to me. Is there a contradiction there?
Well, there's a confluence, an apparent contradiction that becomes a confluence. It's rather like Edward Gibbons said when he was, he wrote, of course, The Decline and Fall of the Empire of the Romans. And Gibbons said that in the Roman Empire, religions, all the gods were equally true to the people, equally false to the philosophers and equally useful to the leaders. So when we talk about the idea that the upper echelons of our controlling elite, Sue Wright Mills cleverly called it the power elite, when we talk about the upper echelons of the power elite being something that's completely unchristian and even un-Jewish, you know, it's a cult. You know, the word occult just means hidden lore. So the idea that the upper echelons of our society are following occult notions and you know, operating in that realm between themselves while leading the rest of us, isn't it all surprising? You know, you'd be a fool to try to start a war on Islam and say, God is dead, Nietzsche was right, Jews are wrong, the Christians are wrong, the Muslims are wrong, there is no religion, but let's go beat up on those people who have Muslim faith. You know, religion is much too good a psychological tool to us. So, look, my background before I got baptized Catholic, because I thought I was going to get what I got, my background was I used to be a non-believing Baptist, which means I got hauled off to church every once in a while and didn't believe it. I think 50% of the pastors I listened to in my entire life were non-believing Baptists. Just because you're an atheist doesn't mean you can't have a good house and a good church. Let's put it the other way around. Good church, therefore a good house. So Bush, let's look at Bush. You know, one of the most clever things I caught on to before the war, I went to my old university. I took my daughter, who's an art student. And I saw some art at the university gallery done by a clever grad student, which showed pictures from The Omen. It showed, like, movie theater art, you know, The Omen, except The Omen, Damien was George. George Bush was Damien. And I thought at the time, I just, you know, I laughed out loud. It was so good. But I realized, you know, what Socrates said, that artists always get it before anybody else does. They just don't know why. That this artist was right. That it's not accidental that Bush is called, you know, a born-again fundamentalist Christian. You know, for God's sake, if you take somebody who is a lifelong alcoholic and drug abuser, who has a salt and pepper, you know, sexual history behind him, and has been part of a kinky-free society called Skull and Bones, for heaven's sake, the only way you got a chance to get the guy elected to office is to make him have a born-again experience. So, you know, some people think believing, you know, fundamentalist Christians who are not going to look outside the envelope to say Bush was a Kenny Bunkport and Billy Graham came out to visit his daddy and his daddy said, oh, won't you please go pray with George? And George accepted Jesus into his life right then and was born again. That's the myth. Now, what's the fact? They were going to launch him on an attempt to take over, you know, to become the heir apparent to the presidency. Daddy had his old CIA connection. They knew that George was such a screw-up that they had to do something to baptize his image. So they did a hasty baptism. They called Billy Graham out, and they rigged the whole thing. It was a baptism a la St. Rose the Divine.
Certainly a PR move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So people are going to say, what do you think? Bush is a Satanist? And the answer is, yeah, something pretty close to it.
Well, Skull and Bones is supposedly the American chapter of the Illuminati, which is both of which are called the Order of Death.
They're a death head order. And if people say, oh, my God, you're so crazy. You're talking about this stuff. You believe in codes. Look, go look up Skull and Bones, pull up their logo, which is inscribed in their, you know, I'm talking about cryptanalysis. So they have their headquarters called the Crypt. It's just the Greek word for hidden, for secret. Means occult. And if you look at their emblem, it's a skull with 2 5 bones under it and the number 322. Interesting enough, again, pretend like we're all mathematicians here, 322, square 3 and you get 9, take half of 2 and you've got 11. 322 and 9-11 are kissing cousins. Mm-hmm. 322 and 311, Madrid, kissing cousins. I mean, man, I'm not the one who made all this stuff happen. They are. So, yeah, and people say, oh, this Skull and Bones thing, are you crazy? It's another fun rabbit hole to go down, and it doesn't lead to nowhere. You know, the last election, the same way that I say we are in a Judeo-Christian war against Islam for the key resource of oil. Well, For God's sake, what academic would argue against that if he could stand back away from this thing 50 years in distance? Clearly that's what it is. Or to say we're in an Anglo-Jewish attack on Arabo-Persian oil. That's another way of looking at it. An ethnologist would look at it that way. Well, in much the same way, people say, well, I haven't heard that. And the answer is, right, the media is there to make sure you don't hear that and to make sure you don't think that. And the next thing would be the election of 2004 was between two Skull and Bones members. For heaven's sake, there are 600 Skull and Bones alumni alive today. 15 are inducted every year into the ultra-elite secret society Skull and Bones on Yale College campus. What are the odds? Let's just be statisticians now, shall we? What are the odds that in the election 2004, the election was between John Kerry, Skull and Bones class of 1964, and George Bush, Skull and Bones class of 1966?
Virtually impossible.
Yep. Somewhere up there. And then you say, well, but you know, okay, well, but I believe the impossible can happen, praise God. Like, okay, well, let's take the next one. So Kerry is married to Theresa Hines. Theresa Hines, in fact, was called the step money because that's what enabled Kerry's political career. What are the odds that Theresa Hines was married to Hines of the Hines family fortune, who himself was a member of, guess what?
Skull and Bones.
Skull and Bones. Yeah. And he died mysteriously in an air crash. Now, I'm just an intel officer, man, but let me tell you what I'd tell any general officer who has asked me what this stuff meant. I'd say, sir, it looks like there's an interior power elite, and that members of that power elite are used for purposes endorsed by that elite and connected allied elite, and that members who are necessarily, who need to be purged, are purged. Ruthless and deficient and it's dominant. And the fact that we don't hear a single word about it in the main media doesn't mean it's not real. It means that it's more real than can be discussed.
There's a great book by Anthony C. Sutton called America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to Skull and Bones, and that book really helped me understand what you're describing there.
Sure, and let me throw in one more alumnus just to make sure nobody misses it. Daddy George was Skull and Bones. So now we've got, let's see who's connected by Skull and Bones. Remember, there are 600 living members. 15 per year are brought in, nationwide. We've got Daddy George, Boy George, John Kerry, his opponent in 2004, Hines, the husband of Theresa Hines Kerry, who died mysteriously, and now let's throw in another, Negro Ponte. Negro Ponte, head of the post-9/11 creation, the National Intelligence Agency, National Intelligence Director, that's right. Yeah. Who, of course, was involved in the Central American anti-Contra wars and was, you know, widely known as somebody who would do anything.
Yes.
Ned Raponte is part of it. Well, I've just named five of the most central people in the power elite equation, all of whom are linked by membership in Skull and Bones, none of whom have ever been mentioned in that capacity by the media.
Right.
Now, am I crazy or are they sold out? You know, it's either or. It can't be both.
Well,
it can't be neither nor, and it can't be both and.
I think these secrets are starting to become more widely known now, and it's very interesting to, you know, this is in the vocabulary of a lot of people now, and it's almost as if this gang is now signing their work a little bit. Would you say that?
Well, no. They've always signed their work, but we're getting able to read the signs.
Right. Yeah.
The signature is becoming apparent to us.
Well, Captain May, could we shift a little bit to other potential?
Oh, by all means.
Yeah, Melody has filled me in as a good and loyal member of Ghost Troop about the situation in Portland, which you describe as noble resolve as a potential 911-2B, and then maybe something in Phoenix. Could you tell us what situations are happening there?
Let's go into that whole area. When one premises that the government that carried out the 911 attack to get the public willing to attack the Middle East with a volunteer military, has to have another shot of adrenaline, a 911 2B attack, in order to totally mobilize for this world war, then one must ask, well, how are they going to do it? You know, what is the modus operandi? And the modus becomes that right now we have exercises, post-9/11 exercises, usually conducted by two entities, Homeland Security, under Chertoff, who, by the way, is a Zionist Jew, and NORTHCOM, the Northern Command, which was set up to establish North America as a military zone after 9/11. Those two agencies, Homeland Security and NORTHCOM, both put on exercises that are about 9/11 2B. Now, they don't use my operational code. You know, I can understand why, but they use my operational scenario. All over America now, several times a year, there are major military and civilian police agency exercises that simulate exactly the kind of things we're talking about. Nuclear attack, usually involving a 10-kiloton nuclear device. And they bring together a large number of these military and police entities. These are the same kind of exercises that were going on when 9/11 itself happened. I suppose it's pretty well known now that Cheney was not in the bunker because the nation was under attack. Cheney was in the bunker because he was part of nationwide air defense activities that involved standing down U.S. air defenses, sending U.S. interceptor planes up to Canada and Alaska, simulated exercises, or simulating attacks on American targets by terrorist aircraft. So Cheney was conducting exercises that did everything possible to screw up the idea of defending the United States on 9/11. In the same way, in London on 7/7, London had 1,000 police officers and private contractors involved in exactly the scenario that happened, to the point that the vehicles, the transportation, the subways that blew up exactly in the places, on the times, and according to the numeric designation of the vehicle. In other words, the exact vehicles they were practicing are the vehicles that blew up. So, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist once you hear this stuff. You might have to be a rocket scientist to hear this stuff, because you're not going to hear it from the mainstream media. But once you do hear it, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out they're using the exercises to set up the event. I mean, it's as basic as this. Before I got sick, I was a second-degree black belt in Taekwondo, so like most low-level black belts, I had to teach classes. So let's say you're a student studying for me, and you're my student, and I say, stand still. And I step forward and throw a punch and end it, you know, bullet, stop it, half an inch from your face. You know, a punch that would break you in two, and I'd stop it a half inch from your face. And that was my way of practicing my skills, and it was your way of practicing the idea of a punch coming toward your face and getting to experience. It was a training device, right? But what if one time you pissed me off and I decide not to pull it? Well, then you have the entire same operation, except this time I don't stop a punch 1/2 inch from your nose. I stop it 1 inch past your nose. That's a false, you know, that's an attack carried out under the premises of being an exercise. And any time we find out that there are military exercises simulating a 9/11 2B type attack, we alert the public. The recent exercises that you spoke about were based on Portland. Portland was part of the Operation Noble Resolve exercises from August 20th to 24th. We found out about these exercises in July. You weren't the first. Other people told us. And we began to investigate. And we found out that they were nuclear simulation exercises, simulating a 10-kiloton attack on the Burlington Northern Railroad Bridge on the Wimmett River in And I started contacting people in the military apparatus. You know, public affairs, I was in intelligence. I have a press credential. I write for the Lone Star Iconoclast. So I started contacting people. And, you know, to find out what was up with these exercises. And what I found was that no two people gave me the same story. Joint Forces Command told me, you know, oh, yeah, it's a nuke exercise, but we don't know the yield. Congressman Peter DeFazio's office told me, oh, we don't know anything about it. The mayor of Portland told me, well, we know about it, but we're not part of it, so we're not worried. And, you know, after a while, you learn when people have got you on a snipe hunt, because they're sending you around in circles. So we started doing research, and we pulled up some kind of project, Defend America or some such thing, a joint project done by Harvard and Stanford, headed up by former Secretary of Defense William Perry, which was about the day after scenario. It's been done in like April of this year, and just coincidentally, they had three maps in the thing. Two very approximate maps of a 10-kiloton attack on Washington, D.C., and one very specific map of a target of Portland, Oregon. Now, again, what are the odds? I know that D.C. is something you factor in anytime you do one of these exercises. I've done these exercises. But why in the hell Portland? I mean, that's like saying Topeka, Kansas. What are the odds? So this study coming up in conjunction with a great amount of misinformation and or disinformation from official sources, coming after Bush had just signed the dictator law, National Security Presidential Directive 51, signed into law on May 9th of this year, coming on the heels of Michael Chertoff's quote, gut feeling, unquote, we were going to be attacked this summer. You know, all this was happening at the same time, so we put out an alert to Portland. You know, heads up. And I'd do it again. The misinformation and disinformation was so thick that one came to the conclusion that either there was a deliberate systemic attempt to deceive us about an unclassified exercise, by the way. If it'd been classified, the correct answer to all my questions was, I'm sorry, sir, I can't answer that. It's a classified exercise. Please submit your questions via Freedom of Information, and we'll endeavor to reply. That's the official answer you give for classified exercise. They didn't do that. They gave me BS. So either A, they were BSing us because they didn't want to admit what was up, or B, it was incredible incompetence. And we've heard the B answer for 9/11. You know, 9/11, we've already heard, oh, no, the Bush people, the military structure, the military-industrial complex, the media, none of those people were behind this. They were just incredibly stupid. So the incredible stupidity argument, you know, we've heard that one before. So we put out an alert, and we followed those exercises. They concluded on the 24th. But by the time they concluded, we had a pretty widespread following for our analytic product among the Portland activist community. And, in fact, we had started a Yahoo user group, which was Portland Nuclear Inquest. And since you brought up the Phoenix thing, the next major exercise, which is even more dangerous in my mind than Noble Resolve, is Top Off 4. Top Off is a shorthand for top officials. It will involve 15 to 20,000 government employees. I do not know whether or not that includes military command. I suspect not. It will be another exercise simulating a nuclear attack, this time three of them currently against Guam, Pacific, Portland, again, and the city of Phoenix. It will occur between October 15th and 20th this year. Just today, Ghost Troop initiated another user group, this one looking for trying to attract interested activists in the Portland area, excuse me, the Phoenix area, which is called Phoenix Nuclear Inquest. And we expect that we'll probably have about 100 members pretty shortly. Because what we found, let's understand InfoWar and false flag attacks and military exercises setting them up correctly. Let's understand this concept correctly. The whole gag, it's like a joke. It only works if people don't know the punchline. If the public has a media apparatus of their own, what we use, the Yahoo user group, or internet articles, or email, or this broadcast that we're doing via the web, nationwide and worldwide, if the public knows the gag, if they know what could happen, then it can't happen. So by simply bringing up the possibility that these exercises, like Top-Off 4, could be used to not just conceptually execute a nuclear attack on Guam, Portland, Phoenix, but to actually execute a nuclear attack on those places. By getting that concept out there, we throw a monkey wrench into the mechanism.
It's fantastic, and of course you get many people helping on these kinds of operations. But it is impossible, isn't it, to know whether your efforts thwarted an attack. Well, you can suspect, but it would be impossible to know. Is that correct?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. See, our Texas City operations, which were the first ones. Again, look, we don't. Right now, you know, you say, well, Captain May, what's your prediction? Do you have any numerological predictions? Do you have any geostrategic predictions? And I say, no, I don't have anything. We've only made a few actual predictions. In fact, I think we've made 7. We've never made a wrong one. In other words, every time we have predicted something, there has either been an explosion of major consequence that affected world markets, or there has been a discovery of a military exercise that had previously been kept from the people. So when everything points so strongly to something that we actually say, red zone day, here's the day, you know, alert, alert. When we actually have done that, it's come out well. On something that we, you know, like the Portland thing, we didn't know absolutely they were going to do it. We just knew that there were what we call an intelligence indicators. There were indicators, and we got the alarm out, and nothing happened. So all I know is that there was an exercise coming up right after the government was setting itself up to establish dictatorship. That's not my speculation, man. That's federal law. Bush signed NSPD 51 May 9th. The day before Congress went on break, it extended his FISA surveillance rights under false pretenses. That was admitted yesterday in the news. So the government was setting itself up for strong-arm tactics, and the officials of the government were saying that the summer was going to be a target time. All we did was specify Portland. After we specified Portland, what we found out basically was that everything the government in various capacities and entities was telling us was BS. So all that does not equal a confirmed abort of a mission. I can't say they were going to hit Portland from the 20th to the 24th. I can only say that there were many indicators. Mm-hmm. But if we go back to something like Texas City, 7/27/2005, remember, this is 3 weeks after I'd gotten myself baptized because I didn't think I'd come out of the mission alive if I got back into it. I knew who I was messing with. The night Texas City, we predicted the 27th. The next night on the 28th, there was a major explosion of British Petroleum, highest crude oil prices in history. And that night, we saw a simulated nuke in the southern horizon over Houston, which reached an elevation of 45 degrees from the horizontal, which means, you've read Chosudovsky's work?
Yes.
We saw an employment of a HARP weapon or something similar, a direct energy weapon, that caused radio distortion, electromagnetic effect, and created a cloud top that, according to my calculations, and I was trained expert in calculating, it was in the area of, stratospheric, talking about something of 40 to 50 miles in height, 100 miles wide, energy disruption, which created an immense field of energy. All I can say is that that particular recording is on tape. I was doing a concurrent broadcast just as I'm broadcasting with you right now, and I was actually describing it as it happened. And there's no doubt in the minds of those of us who were part of those who were part of the effort that had we not become involved, had we not said the government is going to try to hit Houston Metro Petrochemical, that explosion on the 28th would not have been merely the flash. There would have been an actual explosion. What we saw that night was a harmless but magnificent explosion of the southern skyline. The media did not cover it. The ABC, NBC, CBS affiliates didn't cover it. The Weather Channel merely put on TV that it was an electrostatic disturbance. The next day, the Houston Chronicle, the paper of record, merely said that there was a disturbing and alarming flash in the southern skies, but that was related to the Texas City explosion. I know factually, as an NBC, as a nuclear biological chemical warfare expert, that their explanation was impossible. What we saw was the simulated flash that was supposed to happen concurrent with the detonation of a nuke. Much in the same way that the plane hit the towers, okay, credible. Then the towers collapsed, defying all the laws of physics.
Yes.
But the point is, it was the pyrotechnic display necessary to sell the act.
Okay.
What we saw was the pyrotechnic display, and what we intervened against was the bomb.
Was an actual nuclear explosion in Houston?
It was a simulated.
Yeah, but
Texas City DC blew up at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And then shortly after dark, we had the direct energy weapon of some sort. It
okay.
couldn't have been a nuke because it would have had effects that would have been noted in other ways.
Okay.
But it was supposed to simulate a nuke.
What
now,
about,
given that I've been a former instructor of nuclear biology and chemical warfare, I was able to do what's called the cloud top measurement. If anybody out there has a technical background, this is called an NBC One report. An observer's, a scout's report of a nuclear incident, which meant that I was able to measure the cloud top height. And the cloud top height came out to something astronomical. It came out to 45 miles high. So we're talking about something that was an energy field. It happened as soon as dark happened. My best guess at this point is that when we got at 6 o'clock was an abort code. Did they abort it out of the event and just did a conventional explosion? And that paid everybody off, because the idea is these things always involve a payoff. You've got to have a disruption of the market or nobody makes money. So you have the event happen at 6 p.m., conventional, because they aborted out of the nuke. The markets went wild by the next day, so there's the payoff. And what we saw at 9 p.m., that was the pyrotechnic display that originally was to accompany the explosion, which originally was not going to be petrochemical, it was going to be nuclear. That was the big Al-Qaeda nuke attack they were setting us up for. Incidentally, you know about this another way. The man running, at the same time there was a concurrent exercise out of Fort Monroe, Virginia, involving the standard 9-1-1-2B scenario of the military, which is a 10-kiloton nuke. General Kevin Burns was running that exercise, the TRADOC commander, four-star General Kevin Burns. You may remember now that he was the first four-star general in history to be relieved of command. He was relieved of command 2 years ago because of a sexual peccadillo. But that happened about 10 days after we interdicted his exercise to blow up Texas City. So the reality?
Okay.
You know, it's one of those things, man. Look, you know, 100 years from now, you know, after I'm gone and after you're gone, if the record is still out there, it will be determined, you know, was this guy coming up with the most brilliant script since, you know, Bach and Tolstoy, making it all up as he went? Or was he actually telling the truth? And did this show the extent of the media military manipulation of the American public? It all comes down to that.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have anything that, an opinion on the six nukes in that transport, Captain May?
Well, I published a piece on it, Loose Nukes Looming Near. It was my column 3 weeks ago. All I can say is that I consider it to be a military impossibility that it was anything other than directed, or that it was anything other than directed from the highest command authority, meaning the White House. At the time, I speculated it was either meant to rattle the saber at Iran, or to rattle the saber at perhaps a coalition of officers in the U.S. military, you know, that Bush could make it public that he had locked and loaded nukes. You know, it was either a matter of conscientious officers actually saying what had been done, or it was a psychological operation intended to scare someone. But the one thing that's transparent to me is the media story, which is that, oh, geez, this is just another case of astronomical asininity. You know, like I say, that excuse gets old after a while. People can only be so stupid.
And how about the deaths that are possibly a
That's going around, and I've seen the mainstream links. I'm glad you bring it up. I think it needs to be examined. I think it needs to be looked at further.
Could you explain, please, Captain May, the deaths?
We're talking about Minot Air Force Base in South Dakota. For those who may not know, the loose nuke story was about a shipment of 5 nukes, later changed to 6 nukes, which left from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota and arrived at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. This was about 3 weeks ago. Since then, it has been published on the Internet, which I think is the best medium available to the public now, that 6 people have mysteriously turned up dead at Minot. 6 military people.
Hmm.
And that is true. Now, what needs to be clarified, though, and some people have been a little too eager on this, 4 of those deaths were before the loose nukes incident. 2 of them apparently have occurred since then, including one Air Force Airman Blue, last name Blue, who died in Virginia, initially labeled a suicide, which is a standard story if there is an assassination. Not that people don't kill themselves, but also people kill people and say that those people kill themselves. He was involved in security for ordnance, which means he may have actually been a witness. He had actually been said to be one of the people who released the story, who broke the story. I don't know about that. So there were 6 deaths at Minot, which is statistically unusual. 2 of them have occurred since the Air Force incident, the loose nuke incident. There has also been the death of one captain, Captain Troy, I believe, out of Florida, Special Forces Command, former combat pilot from the Middle East War, who arrived in Portland the day after the Noble Resolve exercise. That would be August 25th, 2007, for a friend's wedding, he said. He was discovered dead under mysterious circumstances, Washington State, 5 days later. So, there are mysterious deaths. After stating so many things positively, maybe it's a good thing that there's this one thing where I have to say, I don't know anything positively about this. I know that there are loose ends that I'd like to know more about.
Could
the Internet seems to be a pretty good job. You know, I'll say this about the Internet. The Internet is kind of like, let's say you've got a living room floor, and you want to find the lowest spot in that living room floor. All right? So you bring in somebody who's as smart as Einstein and say, find the lowest spot in that living room floor. They may have a hard time doing it with every instrumentation you have. But if you get somebody who's a janitor just come in and pour a bucket of water in the floor, guess where it goes? To the lowest spot. So the Internet's kind of like that. By banding this kind of information around and by adding to it, expressing it, questioning it, the Internet has become the First Amendment repository. It is the free press. So I look for that story to be further developed.
The situation in Iran now, I'd be interested to get your comments about of course, the scenario that we've been discussing is that there would be a massive nuclear explosion, which would be blamed on Iranians, and then this would be pretext for World War, the extension of World War III.
Well, it would either be blamed on them, or it would simply be used as a way to hype American war sentiment up.
Yeah, so
The same way Iraq didn't do 9/11 according to the official story, but that didn't matter.
Right. So what is your, and nobody has a true crystal ball, but you have a lot more information than most of us. What do you kind of see coming down the pike in terms of how that war, I suppose it could be triggered many ways. It certainly seems to be on the administration's agenda of things to do.
I'd say the top of the administration agenda.
Right.
Understanding the world context now is we're an axis. We're the axis of evil. The United States, the UK, and Israel.
I agree.
If you mention the Israeli part, you're calling the anti-Semite. But those are the 3 countries. That's the Germany, Italy, and Japan. The U.S., the UK, and Israel. Israel considers the war with Iran to be an existential war. And that was one of those philosophical concepts I never quite got. But I understand it in the linguistic sense. What they mean is someone's going to die. Either Iran's going to die or we're going to die. So I would call the war on Iran to be a sine qua non you know, an absolute necessity for the Israel lobby, for the Zionist powers. So I think no matter who you get as the next president, if the war with Iran hasn't happened before that, there will be every possible attempt to make it happen afterwards. I think it will happen as a consequence of a false flag attack. And people say, oh, my God, that's extreme. I say, well, you know, once again, it's extreme to most people because they don't know basic facts. The facts have been hidden from them. I used to accuse the public of being stupid, but now I accuse the media of being deceptive. People don't understand that in 67, as Israel was getting into a war against the Egyptians, they tried to sink our ship, the USS Liberty, with a four-hour sustained attack by air and naval forces, the whole idea of which was to say that the Arabs had done it to bring us into a regional war. So the idea that Israel, either through its foreign branch or the Israel lobby in the U.S., would attempt to do a false flag, I mean, that's axiomatic. That's the basic way that they would do it. So the question is, will it be a consequence of a 9-1-1 to be attack in the U.S., or a consequence of a USS Liberty attack abroad? And the answer is either will work. There are other options. I mean, you know, one hears the story circulated now, I think, by David Wormser, former Mideast advisor to Cheney, big-time Zionist, who came out and said that Cheney had been talking about getting the Israelis to attack Iran, so Iran would attack Israel, and then we'd attack Iran. But I really don't think any scenario other than a false flag will work, because can't enter a regional war against the Middle East using U.S. blood and treasure without first convincing the American people they are under attack.
Okay.
There was something you were going to speak about tonight that you'd mentioned this afternoon.
Well, no, that's the Phoenix nuclear inquest.
Oh, okay.
And I'm glad you give me another chance. Anyone who's interested in that, you can simply look to your search engine. There aren't a whole lot of things named Phoenix Nuclear Inquest, but we've just started one. Or if you can't find that because it's not posted to your search engine yet, try Portland Nuclear Inquest. What we've done is every time we have had a major mission, we have set up an inquest, either beforehand or afterwards, to best understand my position. I go by Captain May because my training and my oath are those of a military officer. I'm on a mission of consequence, a mission of conscience, which has unfortunately had a fatal consequence in my case. So I couldn't take what I'm doing more seriously, nor could I sacrifice more to carry it out. So anytime I do work for the future, or I do inquiry into past events, I set up a formal inquest. Now, right now, people say, oh, you know, it's just a user group and maybe a hodgepodge of intelligence sources. But my answer is no. You know, it's either true or false. I either mobilized myself in this mission of conscience in an info war that existed or that did not. If there has been high treason, should, God willing, the traitors ever be brought to trial, whether I am here or not to vouch for it, my work will vouch that, you know, a conscientious military officer mobilized against it and performed such tasks of inquiry as he was capable of doing. So there is a Texas City nuclear inquest. There is a Houston terror inquest. There is a Chicago 9/11 inquest. That's another thing we didn't get into. But there are five different inquests that I have begun. So, you know, we're an ongoing body of inquiry.
You could say
we're the People's Court of Inquiry into past and future events associated with the original 9/11 treason.
Was one of those inquests into Operation Bono? Or is that a different?
Another area that we call that the Battle of New Orleans, which became Bono.
Bono, yeah.
And that was an inquest. That was a mission code. 1 month after the attempt to blow up Texas City in July of 2005, Katrina hit. And up to the point that Katrina hit, I'd never even heard of weather warfare, weather modification, or the HAARP program. You know, it just wasn't what they say. It wasn't in my lane. It wasn't my problem. But after Katrina, especially going through Rita and Wilma, the two other Category 5 hurricanes to hit the Gulf that summer, we started working on parallel lines with Dr. Michelle Trostakovsky and many others, on the idea of weather modification. And we think we attained conclusive results. New Orleans, you may know, was rehearsing a mythical storm. I forget the name of it. They were rehearsing a killer hurricane scenario for years before it happened, ever since 9/11. So basically, you know, other people look at New Orleans and say, man, bad luck. And I look at New Orleans and I say, man, demolition, urban renewal via hurricane. It's like the Republican from down in Louisiana said, the government couldn't get the Negroes out of the Ninth Ward, but God did. Well, that was just a little way of having a joke about it. But meteorologically, you know, once again, I said to you earlier, if only we had a room full of academics and all the various disciplines that, and I didn't want to get into all these things, it's just that this is where the mission took me.
Right.
Rita, Wilma, and Katrina were happening right down here on my doorstep. A meteorologist could tell you the advent of three Category 5 storms within 2 months in the Gulf of Mexico at the end of the summer extending into the mid-fall, simply a meteorological impossibility. As were the water temperatures that we measured, these were open source materials, as were the continental temperatures we measured. It's just that if you put it together, it's not even a hard story to put together. It's just TV didn't tell you. So, you know, if it doesn't happen on TV, it doesn't happen, most people.
And I've got another question here for you, which takes you to a slightly different direction. But in one of your articles, Captain May, you talk about a terrorist incident of the largest U.S. oil giant, Exxon. This is something different now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that was none of our predictions. We knew that after the first time they hit BP Texas City, we figured out one of their little cult tricks. You know, they're freaks for this kind of Straussian nuance. I'm going to give you the city, and you give me the state. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
First attack to figure out how to do this operation came under Clinton. Oklahoma City, what state?
Oklahoma.
Okay, then the biggie happened 6 years later. New York City, what state?
Tough, New York.
All right. You see, it made no sense to me the first time they tried Texas City. I didn't figure that right away. I got it from a ghost group.
Oh, okay.
Said, hey, Captain May, Houston is the Bush family headquarters. Petrochemicals is the Bush family industry. They're going to hit Texas City again. Or rather, Texas City, Texas. They took four different shots. Hang on. Three different shots on Texas City, Texas. The last one was January 31st, 2006, and we predicted they were going to make an attempt against it. Nothing blew up, but the mainstream media, Galveston County Daily News, carried a major story, which was that nuclear weapons of mass destruction team had shown up on the beach there and was setting up equipment on the day. So we figured after that that probably we hoped that we had spoiled their surprise. But we started getting information in the summer of 2006 out of ExxonMobil. So you've got to think about this as a corporate entity. British Petroleum, we know. British Petroleum is not the TV commercial you see. It's not a pretty sign with green and yellow. So British Petroleum is an international oil magnate, which is about as innocent as British East India Tea Company. It's been involved in things like the Iranian coup of 53. You know, it's a major international consortium. Well, so we realized, okay, these things are going to be coordinated the same way the towers were coordinated through Silverstein and Zions Finance. Okay, well, the Texas City hit is being coordinated through British Petroleum. But then after we kind of upset the alpha cart with Texas City, which is 25 miles south of Houston, we started getting word that ExxonMobil, headquartered in Beaumont, 90 miles east of Houston, was rehearsing terror scenarios. So we put out the prediction that on 7-1, there would be an attempt to hit a Houston area petrochemical target. And we put out a triangle of death scenario from Houston extending due east to Beaumont, extending east-southeast to Texas City, extending north to Houston. It was an isosceles triangle. We called it the triangle of death. And our prediction was it would happen within the Houston metro area, but anywhere in that triangle. The ExxonMobil facility in Baytown, 20 miles east of Houston, blew up one day off prediction and resulted in the highest oil prices in history until this latest surge. I think that's the first time that oil broke 80 bucks a barrel. So, you know, man, you know, people say, oh, it can't be, it can't be. I'm thinking, yes, it can, yes, it can. You can take any one of these missions and you can write a damn good spy book out of it. All I'm suggesting is that when you put together, like, a piece of crap oil suburb, who cares? You know, population 25,000, which is Texas City, which is Baytown, plus an international oil magnate like British Petroleum, or if that screws up, they switch to a secondary like ExxonMobil, in the city that you know, the guy who did 9/11 comes from, where his daddy still lives, in the industry that has bought and paid for George Bush decades ago. Hey, what's so hard about this?
So what you're saying is that a corporation itself could carry out an incident of synthetic terrorism against itself. Is that what you're saying? Or
in collaboration with the government.
In collaboration. Okay, so it's government corporation.
Look, you have got to mobilize the interior forces of the target. Like, you're going to hit the towers. So what do you do? Larry Silverstein, who is closer to Israel than the U.S., buys the thing 2 months in advance. Neil Bush, Bush family, a consortium under his direction, takes over security 1 month in advance of 9/11. Silverstein concurrently increases the insurance by 100%, right? Doubles the insurance policy.
Yeah.
In the weekend before 9/11 happens, which is a Tuesday, the buildings are closed down for rewiring. Yeah, right, rewiring. So you have the whole MO right there.
It's a public-private partnership.
Sure, and that's why the markets always go gaga. Look, it's not an accident that on every one of these attempts on Texas City and later on Baytown, the markets went ballistic. The markets were supposed to go ballistic, man. That way, if you knew about it in advance and you played along, you made money. Why the hell do crime if you're not going to make money? Got to make money. So you've got the whole blueprint right there. You own what you blow up. You pre-invest to make sure you maximize the value of blowing it up. You blow it up, then you cover it up. Let the ARABs and go get some more oil, boys.
Captain May, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's been very informative tonight.
It's been tremendous to have a chance to talk to you and learn all this.
Well, it has been a great honor, and I hope that your listeners were edified and not antagonized too much.
I think so. I think we really appreciate your insights. It's a really fantastic effort you've put together, and I for one am going to look into joining Ghost Troop, as I'm very impressed.
Well,
with
I am
Troop.
Honored. You would be one of the esteemed academics, but not the only one, and that's part of our strength.
Okay, good.
Let Melody talk to you. She's my best recruiter nowadays. Eric, Melody, it's great talking to you.
Thank you, Captain May. Great talking to you too.
Goodbye by saying this is Ghost Troop Captain May signing out from the belly of the Bush Beast in Houston, Texas.
And thank you.
Good night, y'all.
Good night.
And this is KHENLP 106.